It is Monday, September 26, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington. Coming up, presidential candidates Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump prepare for the first televised debate. Colombian officials and rebels prepare to sign a peace treaty ending a long-running war, and a healthcare website funds medical care around the world. It's all ahead. Lights, camera, action. The first presidential debate of the upcoming November election. Democrat Hillary Clinton will be debating Republican candidate Donald Trump. I'm joined now by VOA's Ken Bredemeier. So, Ken, a lot is riding on this. I think this is the first time in public these two have actually debated against each other.
Sure. They've both had quite a few debates within both the Republican and Democratic parties, but now the American public, maybe 100 million of them, are going to watch tonight as the two go face to face.
This is happening as recent polls show a tightening of the race. In a way, who has more at stake here? I guess they both have a lot at stake.
They certainly do, but there's a couple of key points here. One is that Hillary Clinton, a lot of voters still have questions about her basic honesty, truthfulness regarding her use of an email system that she set up in her home while she was Secretary of State. So certainly voters will want to hear about that. But there's also questions about Trump's suitability to be the U.S. leader, to be commander in chief. He often has mangled a lot of facts. And so voters will want to see, can he keep track of U.S. policies and espouse exactly what he would do if he's elected.
In the past, during the Republican primary season, when he would get into these debates, he was sometimes often insulting of towards his rivals or his opponents. You know, tonight, perhaps he will try to appear more presidential, or maybe he will be very tough on Secretary Clinton.
We just don't know at this point, and that's probably why a lot of people are going to tune in to see this confrontation. He could try to present himself as more presidential. He could also insult her face to face. We just don't know what's going to happen yet, but that's why they hold these debates, to give the voters a real look-see at who might be their leader for the next 4 years.
Is it known how much influence these debates have on voters?
Some years, the basic track of the campaign hasn't changed much with these debates. However, there are exceptions. There have been some notable instances over the years where one candidate or another has made what can only be described as a major faux pas, a misstatement of actual facts that just opened them up, or maybe their demeanor on the campaign stage. And so that's another thing that voters will be looking for. How do they respond, these two candidates, known well to the American public? How do they react to each other's taunts?
Thanks very much, Ken. And that is VOA's Ken Bredemeier. And this reminder that VOA will have live coverage of the presidential debate on Tuesday at 1 hour Universal Time on our website, voanews.com. Well, joining me by phone is social media editor Andrew Palshevsky. So, Andrew, we've got a lot happening.
Absolutely. It's the great debate, as I've come to coin it, and I think several other people have. It's probably, according to social media, at least one of the most, if not the most, anticipated a presidential debate in history. And to that end, we see hashtag debates being used, and they have a little podium they put beside that on Twitter. If you use that hashtag, hashtag presidential debates, and hashtag Hoff debate 16. Hoff, of course, for Hofstra University here on Long Island, where the debate will be held. I'll actually be there tonight covering the debate, and I'll be putting up videos on Facebook Live and putting up photos on Twitter. And when I went to pick up my press credentials yesterday, I saw that there was just about everybody else was doing the same, from journalists. And I actually got stopped several times, and people said, oh, can we interview you on Facebook Live? And I said, I'm sorry, I'm a journalist, so I can't work for the opposition. But in addition to the journalists doing that, it was students just filming everything, soaking it all in. This is the third consecutive presidential election that Hofstra has held a debate. But for these students who are on campus, it's for many of them their first time in a presidential debate while being in college. So a lot of them soaking it up, putting as much as they could on social media. And then even people who aren't there, then they get to experience that. The people around the country, even if they're not at Hofstra, are chiming in on this, everything from what they anticipate the candidates to talk about, how Donald Trump might perform, what he might do, to a couple suggestions that I rather liked. Somebody said they should lip sync, do a lip sync battle. Someone else said a karaoke battle. So I think those could be good ways to make it even more entertaining. But I have no doubt that it will be quite entertaining tonight. But right now, it's all the anticipation and just all the excitement on social media that we're seeing, and we'll see how it plays out in about, let's see, roughly 7 hours and 45 minutes from now.
Okay, well, best of luck to you, Andrew, with all of that. That's social media editor Andrew Pelshevsky, who joined us from New York. Here are some of the top stories trending. The Islamic State retakes control of former strongholds in Afghanistan. Iran releases a Canadian-Iranian professor. Portugal's Antonio Guterres leads in the UN Secretary General race. And U.S. violent crime increased in 2015, but remains far below that of the 1990s. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on the voanews.com website and on our VOA mobile app. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
The American Heart Association released a new study that uncovers yet another reason not to smoke. The study, published in the journal Circulation Cardiovascular Genetics, suggests that smoking can have a wide-ranging and long-term effect on our DNA. The research shows that smoking leaves a footprint on the human genome, a complete set of a person's genetic material, in a process called DNA methylation. A study author describes this as one of the mechanisms of the regulation of gene expression, which controls what genes are turned on. While the research shows the DNA footprint greatly diminishes 5 years after a smoker quits, it doesn't completely disappear from the genome even after 30 years of quitting. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Sarah Williams. Coming up, we explore the continuing attacks on the city of Aleppo, Syria. A final peace agreement between Colombia's government and a national guerrilla movement will be signed later today. The conflict between the government and the Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia, or FARC, was funded from the country's illicit cocaine industry. 16 heads of state and 24 foreign ministers, including U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry, are expected to attend the signing ceremony at the Convention Center in the Caribbean port city of Cartagena, founded in the 16th century. I spoke with VOA State Department correspondent Steve Herman, who's traveling with Secretary Kerry, and I asked him about the ending of the longest-running insurgency in the Western Hemisphere.
That is correct, and it's also the last full-blown one that was inspired originally by Soviet and Cuban ideology against democratic institutions in the Americas. And this is a fight that went on for 52 years. The government against a rebellion group whose funding primarily derived from the cocaine industry. Millions of people were displaced, untold numbers of people kidnapped, and more than 250,000 dead.
Well, now you are there. You're accompanying Secretary of State John Kerry. But in addition, there are a number of members of FARC will be there as well.
Right. The leadership of FARC will be here, about 40 of the leaders, and they have agreed to put down their arms and reintegrate their fighters into Colombian society in exchange for massive development in the countryside and also immunity from drug crimes. The United States itself, in fiscal 2017, is planning to inject an extra $450 million into this country, and that's going to do all sorts of things, from bringing in government services to areas that have essentially been lawless for decades, building roads and helping farmers get crops out and getting them to switch over to legal crops rather than coca leaf production.
But not everybody is supporting this agreement. Why not?
Well, there are those who believe that the FARC rebels should not get immunity and amnesty for drug traffickers. The former Colombian president, Alvaro Uribe, is leading a coalition against this. He's a big opposition leader against the government here in the legislature. And he said Colombians have learned over decades of attempted negotiations with other terrorist groups that it is impunity that always becomes the seeds of new forms of violence. But the president, Santos, is saying, look, this is the best deal we could work out. We had to try something. And it'll be the people of Colombia that ultimately decide on October 2nd because there's a referendum about this peace pact. Now it needs to be endorsed by at least 13% of all registered voters. There's no guarantee that'll happen, but it is quite heavily favored in public opinion polls.
That's VOA State Department correspondent Steve Herman reporting from Cartagena, Colombia. Dozens of Syrian and Russian airstrikes on the rebel-held eastern sector of Aleppo has created what the UN Syria envoy Stefan de Mistura has called a chilling, appalling, and tragic situation. Speaking after an emergency UN Security Council meeting Sunday, de Mistura said the U.S.-Russian cessation of hostilities announced September 9th risks, in his words, becoming devoid of credibility.
On the 18th of September, airstrikes did resume on Aleppo. Since then, we have seen the most sustained, intense bombardment since the start of the Syrian conflict on Aleppo in particular. The level of airstrikes is unprecedented in quantity and also in the scale and type. This is inhumane, merciless, sinful, indeed barbaric. It may be tantamount to criminal. It must stop. There are also reports of AOGs firing the so-called hellfire rockets, canisters of gas full of ammunition, at the civilian targets. This must stop as well. 275,000 people are still living in eastern Aleppo. They cannot be all terrorists. But they are under constant form of now de facto a siege for more than 20 days, and hundreds of them have been killed since the airstrikes have returned.
The UN diplomat said the responsibility for ending the fighting rests with the U.S. and Russia, who brokered the ceasefire. He appealed for an end to the violence, the protection of civilians, periodic pauses to allow in humanitarian aid and medical evacuations, a mechanism to enforce and monitor the end of fighting, and a resumption of political talks. Analyst Abdul Qadir Sino of Indiana University tells International Edition's Victor Beatty the forces of President Bashar al-Assad, facing defeat just a year ago, since they now have the momentum to capture all of the vital city.
It will be a tremendous victory for him. He already controls most of Damascus, and Aleppo is actually the largest city in Syria. If he can control it, he can really claim legitimacy and victory on a large scale.
Well, the rhetoric at the UN got rather heated. Samantha Power, the U.S. UN ambassador, said what Russia is sponsoring and doing is not counterterrorism, it's barbarism.
And she's absolutely correct. Also, however, one has to keep in context the fact that the Russians have their own grievances, and they're using Syria to really get even with the United States, especially against sanctions that the United States has imposed on them in the past. So for them, it's an opportunity to get even.
The Russian ambassador, Vitaly Churkin, insisted that the U.S. is at fault because it's unable to separate al-Qaeda and Islamic State from other rebel groups. Is that a feasible argument?
No, because no one can do so. How can you separate those groups from others alongside which they fight? Listen, the resistance in Syria, opposition in Syria, has very limited options. And they're formed of different groups of people for reasons that have nothing to do with Russia or the United States. And it makes no sense to a more moderate opposition group to separate themselves from Al-Qaeda or other organizations along which they fight. They are at a disadvantage vis-a-vis the regime. If they start fighting each other, they're going to lose immediately or very fast to the regime and Russia. It's unrealistic to ask them to start fighting each other just to satisfy the needs of foreign powers. And certainly not in the capacity of the United States to do so, because they can't possibly convince them to do so, because they're intertwined geographically and otherwise. In fact, they share the same front, and they cooperate really well, at least the previous Al-Qaeda organization, Nusra Front, which changed its name right now, and other opposition groups. ISIS is more separate in most areas and can be isolated, and here the Russians have no argument.
The UN Syria mediator, Stefan de Mistura, appealed to the Security Council to come up with a way to enforce a ceasefire. He said he's still convinced we can turn the course of events. Is he overly optimistic?
Extremely so, because he's not taking into consideration the incentives of the Russians and the Syrians and the lack of readiness of the Obama administration to actually intervene more forcefully with the Russians and the Syrians.
Abdul Qadir Sino said the fall of Aleppo to Syrian-backed forces will likely have a domino effect elsewhere in the country, leading to a defeat of the anti-Assad forces. He also said it would be a foreign policy disaster for the Obama administration, which he said has been outmaneuvered by Moscow. He said that could have ramifications for other parts of the world. This is VOA.
The U.S. presidential election takes place on November 8, 2016. VOA provides extensive coverage of this important political event. Who are the candidates, and what are the issues that will determine who the next president will be? Tune in around the clock for coverage of the U.S. presidential election, right here on VOA.
Hey, I'm Nikki Strong. You love music? How about Blake Shelton and Carrie Underwood? Or Merle Haggard and Loretta Lynn? Experience the best in country music on Country Hits USA. I bring you some country rock, outlaw, a little hillbilly, contemporary, and more, with a dash of entertainment news, too. So join me for Country Hits USA on VOA 1, the voice of America.
This is International Edition. Every year, $7 trillion is spent on global health care, but there's still millions of people who need treatment and can't get it. So 6 years ago, Chase Adam, now 29 years old, decided to start a radically transparent international crowdfunding healthcare website, surprised that one did not already exist. His vision to make the world a healthier place by streamlining contributions made Chase Adam the San Francisco Chronicle newspaper's Visionary of the Year. Jan Sluzer looks at the website that sparked that honor.
It was one of those life-altering experiences that happened by chance. Peace Corps volunteer Chase Adam, traveling through Costa Rica by bus, stopped in Watsi, where a woman got on, soliciting donations to pay for her son's health care. Adam had seen people do that before, and they rarely got money. But this woman did, and he wondered why.
And then I found out that she had her son's medical record with her. It was in a red folder, and she was passing it around the bus. And that really resulted in her earning the trust of all these local passengers. So I remember making a donation, and she got off the bus. And then a few minutes later, just thinking, you know, why isn't there a website for this? Why isn't there a website that makes it really easy for people like this woman to raise money for healthcare that they can't afford?
So when his Peace Corps service ended in 2011, Adam set one up, following the model of crowdfunding websites like Kiva that gives money directly to entrepreneurs to start businesses. Watsi funds medical care.
From a donor or user's perspective, you'd go on the website and see photos and stories of patients who need health care but can't afford it. And you can donate as little as $5 and directly fund the costs of their life-changing medical procedures.
Watsi works with a global network of well-respected nonprofit medical organizations, which identify patients in financial need, help them upload their information to the website, and provide the medical care once it's funded. Adam says the criteria for receiving medical help are simple.
The procedures have to cost less than $1,500 US, and they have to significantly improve the patient's standard of living. So these are life-changing or life-saving procedures.
Procedures like cataract surgery, heart operations, cancer treatments, club foot repair, setting bone fractures, and healing burns. So far, WOTC has raised some $7 million for patient care.
Approximately 20,000 donors on our website have contributed to approximately 9,000 patients in 23 countries.
One of those patients is Tibisigwa, a widow and mother from Kenya. For the past 12 years, she had been living with debilitating uterine fibroids. WOTC co-founder Grace Gary, who helps produce patient stories on the web, explains she needed $250 for a hysterectomy so she could regain strength to work, potentially start a small business, and raise her family.
We have an update on her now. Her surgery was a success. She's expected to make a complete recovery. And she says, after the surgery, I feel much better, although I have pain on the operating area. I'm excited about recovering and living without abdominal pain and bleeding. I have 6 children. 5 of them don't live with me. In the past months, when they've been coming to visit me, they've always found me in bed. When I recover, they will find me up or even working. I'm sure this will give them joy. Thank you very much for the help you've given me. God bless you abundantly.
WOTC's mission is to provide health care for every person in the world. As the organization works to expand into more countries, that vision moves a step closer to reality. For VOA News, I'm Jan Sluzer in San Francisco.
That's our show. Thanks for joining us.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
When a country is deemed to have stepped outside of international norms or standards, the community of nations may impose sanctions against the sitting government, non-state actors, or individuals deemed to be responsible for offending acts. The idea is to persuade the offending parties to change their policy by restricting trade, investment, or other commercial activity, and, in the case of individuals, travel to the United States. In the early years of this century, such was the case with Côte d'Ivoire. Seeking to facilitate peace negotiations to put an end to the country's bloody civil war, the United Nations imposed targeted sanctions on certain individuals who significantly contributed to the conflict. Many in the international community followed that lead, including the United States, which imposed sanctions on specific individuals beginning in 2006. Then, in 2010, Ivorians elected opposition leader Alassane Ouattara to the presidency. The president was recognized by the international community as the country's new leader. Nonetheless, the incumbent, Laurent Gbagbo, refused to give up the presidency, and the fighting, which had largely ceased in 2007, was renewed. More sanctions were imposed by the United Nations, as well as by individual countries, including the United States. On September 14th of this year, recognizing that the situation in Côte d'Ivoire has vastly improved, President Barack Obama lifted U.S. sanctions on the Ivory Coast. President Obama determined that Côte d'Ivoire's advances in restoring peace and democracy and developing its political, administrative, and economic institutions represent significant improvements since President Bush declared the national emergency in 2006, said State Department Deputy Spokesperson Mark Toner in a written statement. Côte d'Ivoire has taken important steps to strengthen its governing and economic institutions and reconcile the differences that led to war, said White House National Security Council spokesman Ned Price in a separate statement. Challenges remain as the country continues to tackle difficult land reform issues and works to ensure that the benefits of economic growth are felt throughout the Ivorian population.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.